I'm Joanne Rideout, news director at Coast Community Radio in Astoria, Oregon. Today we're talking about the 10th anniversary this December of a huge storm that hit the Pacific Northwest coast in 2007. Afterwards, they called it the Great Coastal Gale, but anyone who was there can tell you it was way more than that. This storm was a real hummer. It walloped the coast hard, a storm that immediately made it into the record books. Old-timers said it wasn't quite as bad as the Columbus Day storm of 1962, but afterwards, meteorologists said the winds blew longer and caused more damage. Today we'll talk with some of the people who were there. If you lived here then like I did, these stories will take you back to days in December 2007, when coastal communities were temporarily tossed back a few generations. Suddenly, things we normally take for granted were no longer at our fingertips. Some people suffered great losses. For up to 2 weeks, communities had no power, no lights, no heat, no water, no phone service. During the storm, winds blew at more than 100 miles an hour for days. Roofs blew off houses and businesses. Rivers surged way over their banks. Roads closed and communities flooded. Huge trees fell like matchsticks. People died. Let's start with the storm. The Pacific Northwest is no stranger to furious wind and rain. In these parts, you hear people jokingly say that what they call an emergency in other places, here we just call it winter. But in late November 2007, some unusual conditions were brewing in the Pacific that would put that survivor mentality to the test. The 2007 Great Coastal Gale was actually three storms back-to-back that hit the coast over 3 days' time. I talked with Coast Community Radio meteorologist Gordon McCraw about how this unusual weather event came to be. In 2006, Gordon and his family moved to the coast from New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. In 2007, Gordon was a deputy with the Tillamook County Sheriff's Department on the incident command team that handled the storm emergency. In 2008, he became emergency management director for Tillamook County.
Actually, as you said, it was three back-to-back storms that kind of merged and seemed like it was one. It was what we used to call the Pineapple Express, what we now refer to as an atmospheric river. It had a moisture feed that was the remnants of two Pacific typhoons. And looking at the history of it, it's actually considered the strongest storm since the 1962 Columbus Day storm. So the first part of it was December the 1st. That brought a lot of snow. It was a cold system at that time, and it dumped about 14 inches of snow up in the mountains. And then another storm came in right on its heels on December the 2nd, and it brought rain to our area and then a little more mountain snow. It was into that storm that suddenly the temperatures began to rise, and at one point the temperatures in some areas went from freezing up to 60 degrees. In a matter of only 2 hours, and you can imagine with getting over 10 inches of rain and add to that the snow melt, the rapid snow melt at that, that was when we started getting a lot of flood warnings through the entire Pacific Northwest.
All of that was bad enough. Then came December 3rd.
I can remember being a retired forecaster, and the incident command team knew that. They asked me to prepare a briefing, weather briefing for them. And they also knew that I came here from New Orleans. So I told them how ironic was it that the person that ran from New Orleans after Katrina to get away from high winds and rain was briefing Oregon's very first hurricane force wind warning, which was really a warning that was over the coastal waters. But I used it because when you say hurricane force winds, that get people's attention, and that's what I wanted to do at the time. Some of the reports that came in during that time was Bay City had wind reports of 129 miles an hour, and we have on top of Cape Mears a tower that amateur radio group had a weather station on it, and at 129 miles an hour, that anemometer quit. We went up and looked at it later, and it's because it broke off and disappeared. I was down at the fence line looking for it, and the guy on the tower asked me what I was doing. I told him I was looking for the cups that go on the thing. He told me I was looking in the wrong county.
In Elsewhere around the region, wind speeds were clocked that seemed unbelievable. NOAA records show that gusts on the coast reached 137 miles per hour. On Nacelle Ridge in Washington State, across the river from Astoria, winds hit 147 miles per hour. Out at sea, significant wave heights of 46 feet were recorded at a data buoy near shore. Significant wave height is an average term, and waves twice that high are routine. I spoke to the Columbia River Bar pilots after they did a helicopter flyover of the mouth of the river as the storm abated. One pilot told me they estimated 70-foot wave heights offshore. Ship anemometers broke and blew away. Ships lost cargo overboard. The Columbia River Bar, a major avenue for Pacific Northwest commerce into ports like Portland and Vancouver, was closed to ship traffic for days until the seas calmed down. The Oregon community of Renonia in particular was among those that made headlines for catastrophic flooding. The Coast Guard saved residents from flooded neighborhoods where rescue swimmers had to swim into houses to get people out who were trapped on upper floors and attics. On December 3rd, Oregon and Washington governors declared widespread disaster areas in coastal and inland communities.
You recall that we had a lot of flooding and a lot of landslides, and there were a lot of road closures. Of course, Highway 101 through all the normal spots that we still get flooded were closed because of the high waters. Highway 6 was closed. I remember we had several large landslides that took a couple of days to clear. And even I-5 up in the northern part right next to the Washington border was flooded so severely that I-5 was closed for a number of days. And it also impacted the power grid. At the height of the storm, there were 75,000 Washington customers and 36,000 Oregon electrical customers that were without power. And I know for certainty that here in Tillamook County, we were out of power for almost a week in many locations. It took quite a while to get everything back online. I do recall also that it affected the landlines and cell phones in the area because I had to pull out and dust off my amateur radio gear. That's what we used in the incident command to talk to Oregon Emergency Management in Salem. And then I was also talking to the Red Cross in Portland using the amateur radio. And they, too, had stations set up at those locations.
But let's go back to the beginning for a moment, to when the storm hit. Here at Coast Community Radio in Astoria, David Paul was doing his job as usual, hosting the NPR morning news broadcast. He was on the air when suddenly things got dicey.
Morning edition had just started. And I was just launching into the first local segment. And now it's time for more air for local news. I'm David Paul. And, and I think I'd gotten that out of my mouth when, boom! And the whole place shook. It was just thunderous. And the whole building shook, and I thought, what the? But I didn't say it. And I looked out the window of the studio, and there was a tree trunk. And I thought, oh, my God, a tree has just fallen on the station here, right above my head, only a few feet above my head. And it was a big, I believe it was an ash tree that was up above the parking lot. And it was a substantial tree. It was about a foot to a foot and a half through in diameter at the base. So this is not a small tree. This is a large tree.
But at this time, so everything was still working. The electricity and the stuff was still going on.
There was still light, yeah.
Was there a generator? Was the station on generator power yet?
I don't know if the generator had kicked on yet. Mm. As I said, I may have said, what the, or introduced myself. But I looked around. I remember Bob Westerberg was standing in the doorway, and we kind of looked at each other in disbelief and astonishment and alarm. And I think I said something just to see if the needles would move on the board, to see if we were broadcasting. And they did move. So we were broadcasting. And that's when I made the announcement, as calmly as I could. a tree has just fallen on the Tillicum house. And we'll be back. by that time, I think the local segment, it was the first local segment, so it was relatively short. So I think it was time to cut back to Morning Edition anyway, which was good. And that's what we did. And we were still broadcasting. And shortly thereafter, the power did go out, as I recall, and then the generator did kick on.
A picture of that tree would later grace the front page of the Daily Astorian newspaper, along with many photos of other damage around the region. Miraculously, the huge tree managed to land in a place that missed vital equipment, didn't take out any windows, and the century-old building did not collapse. It was like the first domino falling.
With that storm, everything was going down. Power was going out, cell phone towers were going down, telephone service that was interrupted by the slide up in Woodson that cut the fiber optic cable into Portland. So 338 prefix numbers here in town couldn't call 325 numbers
right,
in town,
and
vice versa.
Right.
We had no 911 service. 911 went down. Really, the only way we could... So there was really no cell service, there was no 911, there was basically the only communication in and out of this area was through ham radio operators, and we had the good fortune of having one right here at the station in our engineer, Terry Wilson. And so he was able, through his contacts, his other hams, to keep us apprised of what was going on in other parts of the area, or in other, up in the Long Beach Peninsula, down in Tillamook County, and other parts of Clatsop County, basically, and also to keep us in touch with the emergency teams in all the counties.
So when you were doing, did you just keep coming in every morning and doing the news as your usual schedule?
I pretty much lived here. At the time, I was living up in Clatskanie.
Oh, my gosh.
And commuting from Clatskanie. But the night before they predicted the big blow, I thought, well, you know, I probably ought to stay closer to the station. And so I went out and stayed with my sister at Surf Pines. I heard shingles blowing off of the house during the night, and then I got up early to come into work and had to drive over small trees and power lines and what have you on my way here. Surf Pines, the trees, the pines from which it gets its name, that neighborhood. Afterwards, it looked as if a huge lawnmower had gone through and shortened them off at about the 15-foot level.
Wow.
The ones that didn't blow down. It was just a mess. It was probably not a great place to ride the storm out. Shortly thereafter, we did go on to emergency power, onto generator power, as the transmitter did up at Megler Mountain. And the only part of the station, the Tillicum house that the generator powered was, of course, the studio. But then a few lights in the foyer and around the front desk. The furnace went down. Didn't have any heat in here.
It was really cold,
I remember.
It was
very cold in here. Very, very cold and dark. And, of course, as far as telephone goes, we had to use the old-fashioned dial or punch tone.
Yeah, the plain old telephone service.
Because our phones with the multiple lines, all that, the switchboard, I guess you would, I don't know if you call it that, but that went down. So, and it was that way for about a week.
Well, so then when you came in and did your morning broadcast, what did you talk about? What did you do on the air?
Updates. Ah. Whatever news we got from the hams.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout our broadcast area, that is what we relayed to our listeners. And any news that might be important to them, that might help them cope with the emergency, and also information to dispel any rumors or alarming rumors that were out there. I don't think back then, it was a different era back then. We didn't have social media to spread
That's
things.
Right.
Misinformation wasn't going viral, but it was out there. Mm. So what we tried to do was give everybody information, give them the information that they needed, that they could use, and try to keep people calm, really, in the situation. Tell them where they could go for shelter if they needed to. Tell them how utilities were responding, how the emergency teams were responding in each county. I remember making quite a few trips down to the, well, it's the jail. It's where the county jail here in Astoria is where the emergency team in was set up.
Oh, yeah.
And they were giving regular press briefings. And I was going down to attend those and find out the latest information from them.
And the station had other, like the mayor at that time, Mayor Van Dusen.
Yes.
Wasn't he on KMUN for a while?
Yes, yes. Yeah. He would come up periodically.
Yeah, and talk about things.
Mm-hmm. He and Paul Benoit.
That's right, who was the city manager then.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall how long the power was out here at the station or when it came
back on? Oh, my gosh. It was probably a bit, well, in Astoria, wasn't it about a week, I think?
Yes, I think it was.
And I remember the scramble was on to get fuel for our generators because we were running low.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we did get a propane truck up, I believe, from down in Tillamook.
Wow.
From in Tillamook.
Wow.
It came up. Because Highway 30 was impassable between here and Klatskanai.
Eventually, David was able to get home to Klatskanai by crossing the Columbia River at Astoria and traveling to Longview, crossing back over into Oregon, and then backtracking home. He commuted that way until the road opened. At that time, I lived in rural Brownsmead, east of Astoria, where everybody has a chainsaw. Neighbors sawed a car's width path out to Highway 30 through piles of downed trees. Most everybody who lived here in 2007 has a storm story. When I was pondering who I should talk to for this show, several people around the station told me, you should talk to Linda Perkins, because her story is really something. You may have heard Linda's voice as Marianne Myers' hilarious sidekick on the Coast Community Radio public affairs show, Food Talk. I asked her to talk with me about what happened at her house in 2007. I had no idea what she was going to say when I turned on the mic. I'm grateful to her for being willing to tell her story. Several times during the interview, she was overcome by the memory of what happened and had to stop for a moment. Her story begins in the middle of the night. Linda and her husband Dale were newlyweds and living in an old house on the east end of Irving Avenue in Astoria on a plot of land in the woods. Linda got up after she was awakened by the sound of their dog scratching to get in. Sputnik, as he's called, probably saved their lives because they were both downstairs for what happened next.
It was right after Thanksgiving, so we went to bed, and the wind was really blowing. It was so loud, there was so much noise, and finally about 3 o'clock in the morning, I went downstairs. The fire was still just embers were just glowing a little bit in the fireplace, and there was just so much noise. And then pretty soon, I heard this. It was like tree limbs scratching against the house. There weren't trees that were super close to the house. What it was is Dale had gotten up about midnight to look outside and see that everything was okay, and our little dog Sputnik had snuck out, and he was scratching at the door trying to get back in. So I went outside to see what was going on. I opened the door, and Sputnik dashed in the house, and then I got like all passive-aggressive. You know, I was yelling at Sputnik, but doing it loud enough so Dale would hear me, you know, oh, how did you get outside? When really I'm yelling at Dale. So Dale heard me, and he came downstairs, and he opened the door to look outside, and he just said, holy, and then a tree hit the house. It hit upstairs. It cut the house in half. And what it was is he looked outside and he could see sky, but we were in the woods. There was no sky. And that meant that there were enough trees down that he could see sky. And so a tree hit the house, it cut it in half. And then it was raining really hard. And so we kind of went into like salvation mode. We had, you know, art on the walls. So what we did is we started taking artwork off the walls and putting in a central bathroom and trying to figure out how to save things in the house from rain. And then the trees just started hitting the house. Just one after another. What they sound like is if you had a bunch of microphones set up on the ground and you had a drawer full of silverware in your hands and you just slammed it down on the microphones on the ground, because they would hit, the tree would hit the house and then everything would jump on Josh and make a huge amount of noise, but it cracks first. The tree cracks, and there were trees all over the forest. Every minute they were cracking and falling, but it's just crack, and then there's the Will it hit the house? Will it hit the house? And that part was just unnerving. So when that very first tree hit the house and cut it in half, we were both downstairs at 3 a.m, which was just a miracle. And we had never both been downstairs at 3 a.m. in our marriage, which was not very long. But this big piece, like 5 foot by 5 foot piece of wall board came down the just like a wheel down the stairs, and it hit Dale in the temple, and so he was bleeding quite significantly. So, you know, got him taped up. Then all through the night, the trees kept hitting.
Eventually, they holed up in an intact area of the downstairs part of the house. Sturdy, oversized beams held, despite repeated blows from falling trees. The upstairs 2 floors were almost completely gone, and the storm kept raging. By the time it was light, nearly 70 trees had hit their home. Linda told me she won't watch horror movies because they're too scary, but she wished then that she had, because it would have given her practice being terrified. By morning, it was still blowing, and just one tree was left that could threaten what was left of their house, one huge spruce tree still standing, exposed on the hill.
The beams in the kitchen cracked, but they held. But once it was light, there was one big spruce tree left, and it was big. And it was up on the hill, and it was over the house. And so Dale kept running around the house looking at what was going, because it was exposed on all sides now, that tree. It had no other trees buffering it. And so I kept just yelling at him to come sit down, because, you know, I'm not any mathematical genius, but if we're in 2 different places, my feeling is we have a greater chance that one of us is going to get killed. So he was in the kitchen, and then crack, the tree cracked, and it came swinging down, and it hit, you know, the third floor was gone, the second floor, it crunched through it. It landed over the kitchen table right where Dale was looking out the window, and I screamed my heart out. And it stopped like 4 feet. Okay. It stopped like 4 feet above the ground, right over him. And you know what he did? He ducked. He ducked. He is the luckiest man. He has these cat-like reflexes. He has this optimism. It's just the most amazing thing. So he just ducked, and the tree smashed through the kitchen, and he got up, and he was alive, and the house was very old, that part was built in 1881. So of course, at some point in that 120 years, there had been vermin at somewhere. So there's all this mouse crap that came down when the ceiling came down, and he just brushed it off his hat, and I was just apoplectic. What, I mean, just beside myself. And he saw that. So then he's like, okay, I'll come sit by you. Cause I had 2 chairs under what I thought, under those beams in the living room that saved our lives, that I thought was the place we were most likely to survive.
In Oregon, total direct public losses from the storm added up to about $300 million, with $62 million in infrastructure and $94 million in housing alone. Timber losses also accounted for $42 million. The storm caused at least $1 billion in damage to Washington State. All told, 18 people died. Gordon McCraw.
One of them was in Tillamook County, and unfortunately it was a lady who had driven through some high water to get her mail, and the vehicle was swept away into the Nehalem River, and we recovered the truck, but we never found the lady.
For years after the Great Coastal Gale, every time the wind blew, locals got nervous and started worrying that the worst was happening again. So far, it hasn't.
So many repairs were made in the aftermath of this storm that the utility system is pretty hardy now, and outages aren't so common as they used to be. That's all well and good, but we still live in the Pacific Northwest. Since then, I carry a small flashlight in my pocket or purse, just in case. Here's David Paul.
It's hard to believe that it's been 10 years since that storm. And I think it was a real wake-up call to all the emergency responders and about how vulnerable we were to that sort of thing. And I think the county, the community, certainly we here at the station, I think we're much, much better prepared for another episode like that, if one should occur, and I hope one doesn't. But, you know, it's we're prepared now, much better prepared now. My final thought is that this station did not go off the air through that whole week. This was the only station in the area that was on the air and remained on the air, bringing information to our listeners. And I remember a while later going up to the Long Beach Peninsula and introducing the North Coast Corral. And one of the members of the corral said, wait a minute, don't sit down. Don't sit down just yet. And I thought, what? And then he said, folks, this fellow, you heard his voice and the voice of other voices at KMUN. They stayed on the air, giving us the information we needed all through this, all through the weather, all through the storm. And I got a big round of applause. It was nice. That was wonderful. It was very, very gratifying. It really drove home how important what the station does here is to the community.
In the ensuing days, power company and cell service workers became neighborhood heroes too, as they painstakingly replaced aging wires and infrastructure that in some cases was blown out completely by the raging winds and rain. They got hugs, cookies, and lots of praise from grateful customers. Gordon McCraw tells me that it's really impossible to predict where and when a storm like this will happen again. And like David Paul said, we're better prepared than we were. I'm Joanne Rideout, News Director for Coast Community Radio. Thanks for listening to our show about the Great Coastal Gale of 2007. And if you still live here like I do, you might want to get some batteries for that flashlight. After all, December's coming around again here in the Pacific Northwest, the place we call home.